From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The result of the voting is as follows. 14 votes in favor, 0 vote against, 1 abstention. The draft resolution has been adopted at Resolution 27-28-2024.
Israel's continuing to attack Gaza despite a vote Monday by the UN Security Council calling for a temporary ceasefire during the month of Ramadan. The U.S. abstained, sparking outrage from Israel, which wanted the U.S. to veto the measure. We'll speak with Craig McIver, a former top U.N. official who resigned in protest over Israel's assault on Gaza. But first to London, where a British court has put the extradition of Julian Assange on hold until the United States provides more assurances about how the WikiLeaks publisher will be treated in U.S. custody.
Today's decision is astounding. The courts recognize that Julian is exposed to a flagrant denial of his freedom of expression rights, that he is being discriminated against on the basis of his nationality, an Australian, and that he remains exposed to the death penalty.
We'll hear from Julian Assange's wife, Stella, then speak to the British MP, former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn. Plus, a judge in New York has decided the first of Donald Trump's four criminal trials will begin April 15th. We'll speak to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The High Court in London has put the extradition of Julian Assange on hold until the United States provides more assurances about how the WikiLeaks publisher will be treated in U.S. custody. The court asked the U.S. for assurances Assange will be permitted to rely on the First Amendment, that he will not be discriminated against at trial because he's Australian, and that he will not face the death penalty. The court also ruled Assange may be able to file additional appeals to block the extradition, but that will depend on how the U.S. responds to the court's request. Assange has been held in London's Belmarsh prison for 5 years, awaiting possible extradition to the U.S., where he faces up to 175 years in prison for publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. We'll have more on the story after headlines. The UN Security Council approved a resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and the release of all remaining hostages. The resolution passed 14-0, with the U.S. abstaining. Nearly 6 months into Israel's war on Gaza, it's the first time the Security Council successfully passed a ceasefire resolution after four previous attempts and continuous obstruction by the United States. After the resolution passed, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu blasted the U.S. for what he called retreating from its, quote, principled position and canceled a planned visit by an Israeli delegation to Washington, D.C. U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres said a failure to implement the ceasefire, quote, would be unforgivable. Palestine's U.N. Ambassador Riyad Mansour spoke after the vote.
This must be a turning point. This must lead to saving lives on the ground. This must signal the end of this assault of atrocities against our people. A nation is being murdered. A nation is being dispossessed.
We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. Despite the ceasefire resolution, Israel's continued to pummel the Gaza Strip. A bombing of a house in Rafah killed at least 18 people earlier today, including at least 9 children. This is one of their surviving relatives.
9 children. The oldest was 8 years old. They all had nothing to do with this. They fell asleep with the news of the Ramadan ceasefire, only to wake up. They didn't wake up. They are not here anymore. I have no one left in this world. No one.
Officials say at least 12 Palestinians died after hundreds swam into the Mediterranean Sea to retrieve aid that had been airdropped northwest of Gaza City. The UN Human Rights Council published a draft report Monday that found reasonable grounds to believe that Israel's committing genocide in Gaza. UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese writes, quote, "The overwhelming nature and scale of Israel's assault on Gaza and the destructive conditions of life it has inflicted reveal an intent to physically destroy Palestinians as a group," she wrote. In Baltimore, Maryland, search and rescue efforts are underway after multiple vehicles plunged into the Patapsco River following the partial collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in what local officials are calling a mass casualty incident. Two people have been rescued so far, one severely injured, but some 18 others could still be trapped in the freezing cold water. The four-lane Francis Scott Key Bridge is 1.6 miles long and part of the Interstate 695, a key commuter route. Maryland Governor Wes Moore has declared a state of emergency. The bridge collapsed after a large cargo ship collided with it early this morning. The 948-foot vessel was just minutes into its journey to Colombo, Sri Lanka, when it hit a column of the bridge. The bridge was built in 1977. In Senegal, Bassirou Diomaye Faye has declared victory in Sunday's presidential election. His main rival, former Senegalese Prime Minister Amadou Ba, called Faye to concede Monday after provisional results put Faye at over 53% of the vote. Faye turned 44 on Monday. He'll become Africa's youngest elected president. He has vowed to fight corruption and poverty and to direct Senegal's revenue from natural resources to provide better economic opportunities for residents. Faye spoke Monday from the capital, Dakar.
The Senegalese people have chosen to break with the past, to give substance to the immense hopes raised by our vision of society. I hope that our vision of society has given substance to their aspirations. I pledge to govern with humility and transparency, and to fight corruption at all levels. I pledge to devote myself fully to rebuilding our institutions and strengthening the foundations of our way of life together.
Bassirou Diomaye Faye is backed by the popular opposition leader Ousmane Sonko, who was forbidden to run. Until recently, the two men were sitting in prison cells, but they were released just 10 days before the election after outgoing President Macky Sall granted the pair amnesty. In Ecuador, the mayor of the coastal city of San Vicente was found shot dead in a car Sunday. Brigitte Garcia was 27 years old, Ecuador's youngest mayor. Her communications director was also killed in the attack. Ecuador has been under a state of emergency since January due to rising violence by armed groups linked to the drug trade. This is Ecuadorian President Daniel Noboa.
The assassination of the mayor of San Vicente and her communications director also remind us that this fight is not over. It has only just begun. It also gives us a warning and precise information that there is narco-terrorism within public institutions and there is narco-terrorism among public officials, which we are cleaning up. Still, very soon, this will come to light.
NBC News has come under fire by its own star anchors for hiring former Republican National Committee Chair Ronna McDaniel as a political analyst. On Monday, MSNBC hosts, including Mika Brzezinski, Joe Scarborough, and Joy Reid, all called out the decision on their live shows. Rachel Maddow, MSNBC's highest-rated anchor, devoted a 30-minute monologue to the news.
The person who is the head of the Republican Party during Donald Trump's time in office and during his effort to throw out the election result and stay in power anyway, and during his effort to run for election again after having done that, is Ronna Romney McDaniel. And she pitched in and helped. She helped set in motion the part of the plot that involved sending fake Trump electors to Congress.
Rachel Maddow added, quote, "You're priming the American public to not accept the results of the next election either," she said. Chuck Todd also fiercely attacked his own network. A New York appeals court on Monday reduced Donald Trump's bond to $175 million in a civil fraud case, down from $464 million, and gave Trump an extension of 10 days to pay it as he appeals the case. The ruling means New York Attorney General Letitia James will not be able to enforce the judgment against Trump just yet, including the seizure of his assets. Separately, Monday, a New York judge rescheduled the start of Trump's hush money trial for April 15th. Trump's lawyers had sought to postpone his first criminal trial, arguing the recent release of over 100,000 pages of evidence made it impossible to prepare in time. The judge harshly disagreed. We'll have more on that story with David K. Johnston, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. The U.S. Supreme Court's hearing arguments today in a case that could severely limit access to the abortion pill mifepristone, which is used for roughly two-thirds of all U.S. abortions. Last year, the Fifth Circuit Court sided with a right-wing Texas judge who ruled the FDA improperly eased regulations on the bill to make it more accessible some 20 years ago. The Supreme Court that overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022 will now decide whether to reverse the FDA measures which made the pill available through the mail and via telemedicine. It could also roll back the FDA's decision to lengthen the window within which mifepristone can be taken, which is now through 10 weeks of gestation. And here in New York, Home Health Aides ended their six-day hunger strike Monday, during which they called on the city to end grueling 24-hour workdays. The home health workers, the majority of whom are women of color and immigrant women, have been demanding New York City Council Speaker Adrian Adams bring the No More 24 Act to a vote. Democracy Now! Spoke to some of the hunger strikers outside City Hall.
For many of us working 24-hour workdays, we are forced to work these kinds of shifts. Because if we refuse, then a company won't assign us work. Only 24 hours or very few hours. So we really need to stop this kind of practice.
We will continue to fight against the 24-hour workdays until Adrian Adams passed the No More 24 Act to stop it. Otherwise, she will have to step down.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The High Court in London has put the extradition of Julian Assange on hold until the U.S. provides Britain with more assurances about how the WikiLeaks publisher will be treated in U.S. custody. The court asked the U.S. for assurances that Assange will be permitted to rely on the First Amendment, that he won't face discrimination at trial because he's Australian, and that he will not face the death penalty. The London High Court also ruled Assange may be able to file additional appeals to block the extradition, but that'll depend on how the U.S. responds to the court's request. Julian Assange has been held in London's Belmarsh prison for nearly 5 years, awaiting possible extradition to the U.S., where he faces up to 175 years in prison for publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. Julian Assange's wife, Stella, spoke outside the courthouse just before our broadcast.
Today's decision is astounding. The courts recognize that Julian is exposed to a flagrant denial of his freedom of expression rights, that he is being discriminated against on the basis of his nationality, an Australian, and that he remains exposed to the death penalty. And yet, what the courts have done have been to invite a political intervention from the United States to send a letter saying it's all okay. I find this astounding. 5 years into this case, the United States has managed to show the court that their case remains an attack on press freedom, an attack on Julian's life. What the courts haven't agreed to look at is the evidence that the United States has plotted to assassinate Julian, to kidnap him. Because if it acknowledges that, then of course he can't be sent to the United States. Julian is a political prisoner. He is a journalist, and he is being persecuted because he exposed the true cost of war in human lives. This case is a retribution. It is a signal to all of you that if you expose the interests that are driving war, they will come after you. They will put you in prison and they will try to kill you. Julian is just a few days away from the fifth anniversary of his arrest and imprisonment in Belmarsh prison. He has been in Belmarsh for 5 years without conviction, and the charges against him are to punish him for publishing the truth, for publishing evidence of the war crimes committed by the country that is trying to extradite him. Now, the UK courts have invited the United States to issue assurances. The Biden administration should not issue assurances. They should drop this shameful case that should never have been brought. Julian should never have been imprisoned for a single day. This is a shame on every democracy. Julian is a political prisoner. He is a publisher, and he is being published for expressing his political opinion, for expressing freedom of the press in its purest form. Free Julian. I ask everyone to rally behind him and call for his freedom, call for the Biden administration to drop the case and support House Resolution 934 before the U.S. Congress to drop this case. Thank you.
That was attorney Stella Assange, the wife of Julian Assange and mother of their two young children. We're joined now by British MP, that's British Member of Parliament Jeremy Corbyn, who served as the leader of the Labour Party from 2015 to 2020. He's standing outside the High Court. Welcome back to Democracy Now! MP Corbyn, if you could start off by responding to the court's decision and if you can explain it in lay terms.
Thanks, Amy, and it's a real pleasure to be on the program with you. And this morning there was a decision by the court which, as Stella has pointed out, effectively invites the USA to give some assurances. But it also gives the opportunity for a further appeal by Julian against his removal to the USA. But if we can sort of unpick the whole thing, the reality is the pressure needs to now go on to the Biden administration, go on to President Biden, to say, look, you are trying to get somebody extradited from Britain under the Espionage Act, the same act that was used against Daniel Ellsberg, to be put into a supermax prison for the rest of his life, a death penalty. Why? Because he told the truth about Afghanistan, about Iraq, because he told uncomfortable truths about many other issues around the world. And if Julian goes down for this, every serious journalist around the world is going to be slightly more cautious about exposing war crimes, exposing corporate greed, and so many other things. And so I appeal, if I may, through you and your audience on Democracy Now!, we need the maximum pressure all across the USA on the Biden administration, on the candidates in the forthcoming election, to say, drop the charges against Julian Assange. We've had a big crowd outside the High Court here, and the date has been set for return here on May the 20th, and we'll obviously be back here. But I should also say the support for Julian is growing. We've got good decisions out of the European Parliament, that's the European Union Parliament. We've also got good decisions out of the Council of Europe, which is a parliamentary assembly, I'm a member of it, of all European countries. We've also got the support of a significant number of governments around the world, Mexico, Brazil, Colombia, and so on, all around the world. And so we have got through today. We've got a slight move forward, but it's no more than that. It's now up to us, all of us, who believe in democracy, believe in freedom of speech, to put that pressure on the Biden administration, and in the case of Britain, on my own government here, where the Home Secretary ultimately has the right to decide whether or not an extradition goes ahead. Whatever the courts say, ultimately it's a political decision by the governments of the day. And there's a growing number of us in the UK Parliament that will continue putting that pressure on as well.
And Jeremy Corbyn, you mentioned the support for Julian among institutions in the European Union. How likely would it be, regardless if the British authorities and the courts decide to extradite him, that the European Court of Human Rights might intervene in the case?
The next stage would be to take the case to the European Court of Human Rights. European Court of Human Rights is not a European Union institution. It's much older than that. It was founded in the post-war settlement when the European Convention on Human Rights was set up. And it is a court that meets in Strasbourg and has judges elected from every European country. And pretty well all of them except Russia and Belarus are in the European Council of Europe and therefore in the European Court of Human Rights. And the case would go there under the convention rights. And it's significant, the numbers of members of the Council of Europe Parliamentary Assembly that have shown their support for Julian Assange. Now, obviously, that would be a political expression. This would be a judicial decision. But if it goes there, that would be, in my view, a good thing. But the much better option would be if President Biden recognized that within the terms of his job as President of the United States, to defend the US Constitution. Does the US Constitution not protect the right of free speech, the right of assembly, the right to publish? That's really what it's about.
And there have been some media reports that the Biden administration was considering a plea deal, which would end up with Julian pleading guilty to a lesser charge, but then not having to serve any time in prison. Your reaction to, do you think this is another a fallback position that the Biden administration is considering?
Well, it shows, if the Biden administration is even thinking about that, that shows they're having second thoughts about their decision to pursue the Espionage Act against Julian. I don't know what negotiations have gone on or not gone on. What I do know is that Julian has suffered unbelievably in almost 5 years in a supermax prison in Britain, the most maximum security prison we've got in this country. The conditions there are pretty awful. And before that, he was 5 years almost in the Ecuadorian embassy. My principle is that he is being punished for publishing extremely uncomfortable truths about Abu Ghraib, about Afghanistan, and about much more else around the world. And he's an embarrassment to governments like those that have committed war crimes around the world. Well, surely all of us that believe in democracy should now be standing alongside Julian.
Jeremy Corbyn, I know you just have a minute to go, and I want to switch gears for a moment, though. I would assume if Julian Assange were out of prison and he were fully able to operate WikiLeaks, we'd be finding out a little more about Gaza. But I did want to ask you about Gaza and the UN Security Council resolution that Britain voted for, the U.S. abstained, calling for a temporary ceasefire during Ramadan. Your thoughts on the overall situation there, what Britain, what the U.S. Should be doing right now, and what you feel Israel should be doing?
The situation in Gaza is obviously a global disgrace. 32,000 people dead on top of the 1,000 people that were killed on October the 7th. And eventually, the UN Security Council not being vetoed by the USA is a testament to the strength of all those that have demonstrated all over the world in support of the Palestinian people to demand a permanent full ceasefire. That happened yesterday. The British government eventually voted for the Ramadan ceasefire, which is good, which is a step forward, and that's only because of the sense of political pressure in Britain. We've had now 10 national demonstrations, and we've got another one on Saturday. We are an enormous growing force of people that want to see peace and want to see the withdrawal of Israeli troops, an end to the occupation, and justice for the Palestinian refugees. And Netanyahu is now in a difficult position because, in effect, he's been disowned by the rest of the world, and even the USA didn't veto the UN resolution yesterday. And so I do appeal to those good people in Israel that have always opposed the occupation and continue to oppose the war to keep up whatever pressure they can there. We need a ceasefire to save life. Listen, 32,000 dead, half of whom are children. Famine, starvation, and as the weather warms up in Rafah, and I've been in Rafah, it's not a big place, it's going to be cholera because of the lack of sanitation. Children dying on the streets for lack of food, lack of water, lack of medicine, when a few kilometres away there's food, there's water, there's medicine in unlimited supplies. The agenda, I believe, of the Netanyahu administration is to force the Palestinian people of Gaza through the Rafah crossing into the Sinai and create another Gaza. And with that, another Nakba. It's time to stand with the Palestinian people. And at least we made some progress at the UN yesterday, but we've got to go a lot further and a lot faster to stop the bombardment, stop the killing, stop the bombing, and get the food and medicine in urgently to support the Palestinian people.
Jeremy Corbyn, we want to thank you so much for being with us again. Member of the British Parliament, served as Labour Party leader from 2015 to 2020. He's standing up outside of the London High Court, which has put the extradition of Julian Assange on hold for a few weeks until the U.S. provides more assurances about how the WikiLeaks founder would be treated in a trial and to guarantee that he would not face the death penalty, though he does face up to 175 years in prison. Coming up, we will look more at how Israel's continuing to attack Gaza despite the vote by the UN Security Council calling for a temporary ceasefire during Ramadan. Back in 20 seconds.
So you think you can tell heaven from hell, blue skies from pain? Can you tell a green field from a cold steel rail? A smile from a veil? Do you think you can tell? Did they get you to train your heroes for ghosts, hot ashes for trees, hot air for a cool breeze, cold comfort for change? Did you exchange a walk-on part in the war for a lead role?
Wish You Were Here by Pink Floyd. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Israel is continuing to attack Gaza despite a vote Monday by the United Nations Security Council calling for an immediate ceasefire during the remaining 2 weeks of Ramadan and calling for the release of hostages in Gaza. 14 of the 15 nations on the UN Security Council voted in support of the resolution, which was drafted by the non-permanent members of the Council. The United States abstained, ignoring a request by Israel to veto the ceasefire resolution. The U.S. had previously vetoed three other ceasefire resolutions. Israel denounced the UN vote, as well as the U.S. decision to abstain. The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, responded by canceling a visit to Washington, D.C. by a high-level delegation this week to discuss Israel's plans to attack Rafah. At the United Nations, Palestinian Ambassador Riyad Mansour praised the ceasefire resolution.
This must be a turning point. This must lead to saving lives on the ground. This must signal the end of this assault of atrocities against our people. A nation is being murdered. A nation is being dispossessed. A nation is being displaced for decades now, but never at this scale since the Nakba.
Israel's vowed to ignore the resolution. In a post on social media, Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz said, quote, "The state of Israel will not cease firing. We will destroy Hamas and continue fighting until the very last hostage has come home," he said. Meanwhile, the U.S. is at odds with the U.N. over whether the resolution is binding or not. Deputy U.N. spokesperson Farhan Haq said U.N. Security Council resolutions are, quote, "as binding as international law." But on Monday, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., described the resolution as non-binding.
"We appreciated the willingness of members of this council to take some of our edits and improve on this resolution. Still, certain key edits were ignored, including our request to add a condemnation of Hamas. And we did not agree with everything in the resolution. For that reason, we were unfortunately not able to vote yes. However, as I've said before, we fully support some of the critical objectives in this non-binding resolution. And we believe it was important for the council to speak out and make clear that our ceasefire must, any ceasefire, must come with the release of all hostages. Indeed, as I've said before, the only path to a durable end to this conflict is the release of all hostages."
For more, we're joined by Craig McIver, international human rights lawyer who formerly served as the director of the New York Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, where he worked for more than three decades as a human rights official. He resigned in October over the UN's failure to adequately address large-scale atrocities in Palestine and in protest of Israel's assault on Gaza. Craig McIver, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you explain the significance of this UN Security Council resolution, the U.S. abstaining, and whether or not this is binding?
Well, thank you, Amy and Juan. Nice to be with you again. It is significant. You've picked the right adjective there, because this was a draft that was put forward by the non-permanent members, the elected members of the Security Council, the so-called E10. And these 10 members include representatives from around the world, including some key allies of the United States, which created, I think, a degree of political pressure that added to hopes that the resolution would not be vetoed in this case. I have to say that it follows just a few days after the council rejected a rather cynical draft that was submitted by the United States, the text of which I have said is a kind of an anti-ceasefire resolution. It didn't order a ceasefire, but effectively set out Israel's conditions for ceasing its violations of international law. And that was a real problem, because a lot of U.S. media outlets were reporting on that resolution as a ceasefire resolution when it was anything but. But yesterday's resolution was an actual ceasefire resolution, a rather weak one, which I will comment on. But it is a ceasefire resolution. It calls for a brief ceasefire, for access for humanitarian aid at scale, for lawful treatment of prisoners, including Palestinian prisoners, and for release of hostages. And it's important because, you know, we're in the midst of a genocide, and you have this nearly moribund Security Council that has failed for 6 months, that is finally succeeding, at least, in demanding a temporary ceasefire. Any pause will save lives, and any aid that gets in as a result during an imposed starvation will make a difference, no doubt about it. It's also important because it's a signal, again, of the very broad consensus across the global community against Israel's onslaught on Gaza, and it will be another legal tool that can help in holding perpetrators accountable after the provisional order of the World Court on Israel's genocide. But, you know, unfortunately, while it contains some hopeful, aspirational language that may lead to a lasting ceasefire, it only demands a ceasefire during the month of Ramadan, which will end in just over 2 weeks. So it is a very short pause during this genocide. And then we know that one of the U.S.'s conditions for not vetoing the resolution was the deletion of the word permanent, which, of course, changes the substance of the resolution very significantly. So despite all of this talk about tensions in U.S.-Israeli relations and this rare instance of the U.S. not vetoing a resolution on Israel's behalf, the U.S. is clearly continuing to run interference on behalf of Israel at the U.N. And as you say, this is made all the more clear by the statements of the U.S. immediately after the adoption of the resolution, in which the U.S. has claimed, entirely falsely, by the way, that the ceasefire demand is conditional on the release of hostages, and secondly, that the resolution itself is non-binding. Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., made these claims in the session of the Security Council after the adoption of the resolution. Both of these claims are completely false and have no legal grounding. The U.N. Charter in its Article 25, subsequent decisions of the International Court of Justice have made this undisputable. Security Council resolutions are binding on all member states. And this is, you know, this is black letter law in the charter that says that all members of the United Nations are bound to accept and carry out the decisions of the Security Council, as I say, subsequently affirmed by the International Court of Justice. And the claim that the ceasefire is to be conditioned on other factors like the release of hostages, this is completely false as well. This was a key central focus of the negotiations, was to make sure that these things were not conditioned one on the other, but they are separate demands of the Security Council. The United States knows this, but it is cynically distorting the record in order to, on the one hand, be able to claim that it has gone along or not blocked an international move toward a ceasefire because of pressure from domestic and international constituencies, and on the other hand, making sure that nothing really changes on the ground. It shows how the U.S., how committed the U.S. has been to undercutting the resolution even before the ink was dry. So if you look at the process, the U.S. used its power to water down the text during negotiations. It still did not vote in favor, only abstaining, and then immediately and falsely declared that it's non-binding and conditional. And in the end, I have to say, we also know that Israel is unlikely to respect any of the terms of this resolution. They've already declared that they will not do so. And they have continued all of their military offensives and genocidal assaults on the Gaza Strip since the adoption of the resolution. We also know that the United States is very unlikely to use any leverage to compel Israel to comply with the resolution. And their language now on trying to claim that it's non-binding is evidence that that is their intent. So the killing continues. Forced starvation continues, genocide continues unabated. And I think that may be the most. Yeah.
Craig Mokai, but what would be the potential actions of the United Nations to a member state that does not adhere to a binding resolution of this type? And also, what is your response to Prime Minister Netanyahu's canceling of the Israeli delegation to the U.S. over this vote?
Well, I think Israel's intentions have been made clear. If you listen to the statements of the prime minister and other cabinet ministers and military leaders, they have been clear from the beginning that they will not relent in their assault on the Gaza Strip until they've effectively accomplished the destruction of the entire Strip. And their attacks now on Rafah in particular show that, you know, the last refuge, the last piece of the Gaza Strip that hasn't been effectively destroyed is not only in their sights, but already under their bomb. So Israel never has had any intention. In fact, Israel has the world record for violating Security Council, General Assembly, Human Rights Council resolutions in the United Nations, and that that is unchanged. But this resolution can make a difference. On the one hand, there is an opportunity if Israel is in breach of the resolution to bring a resolution for enforcement under Chapter 7. Now, of course, as we've said, the United States is likely to block, to veto that resolution to prevent any enforcement, just as they will continue to block any enforcement of the decisions of the International Court of Justice regarding genocide in Palestine. In this case, because the U.S. has not vetoed it, they have, in effect, blocked action in the General Assembly under the Uniting for Peace resolution, where you could have seen some real meaningful action. You could have seen a resolution with teeth, with substance, resolution that included diplomatic, military, political, economic sanctions, not the enforcement of those sanctions, but the call for those sanctions, the deployment of a protection force, the establishment of a tribunal, the establishment of permanent mechanisms, as was the case within the United Nations during apartheid in South Africa. So there are actions that could be taken here, but the non-veto has slowed action in the General Assembly, while at the same time allowing the United States to claim that, yes, the resolution passed, but somehow it's not binding. In the end, this all comes down to the first to the political will of member states across the organization, which already, after the provisional measures of the International Court of Justice, are obliged to be taking action to rein in Israel's assault on Gaza. Few have done so, but I think there is pressure building. And then secondly, the obligation on all of us in civil society to make sure that we keep up the pressure, again, as was the case in South Africa, on our own countries, to make sure that there are appropriate sanctions imposed on Israel to force it to comply and to end its genocide.
I wanted to turn to Kamal Qasem. He's a displaced Palestinian in Gaza responding to the UN Security Council vote in New York.
We hope that the decision is implemented and that it is taken seriously, because we know that Israel is stubborn and doesn't pay attention to the Security Council or any Western countries or Arab countries. And you can see what the situation is like, and the life that we are living is very, very difficult, with big massacres and genocides. Not just one genocide, and the situation is very, very hard, and we hope a ceasefire comes quickly and that the decision is implemented.
So, Craig McIver, I'm wondering if you can respond to that. And also, we're getting all sorts of reports on whether the Qatar talks are continuing those negotiations. Majid al-Ansari, a spokesperson for Qatar's foreign ministry, tells reporters negotiations on a truce are still ongoing. He rejected Israeli claims that the UN Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire had an immediate impact on the talks. The Times of Israel said Israel has cut off Gaza truce talks in Qatar as a result. Your response and where you see this all headed at this point. I mean, even as we talk about whether Israel is going to launch a full-scale invasion, I think in the last 24 hours since the UN Security Council resolution was passed, something like 80 to 100 Palestinians were killed, most of them in Rafah.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the challenge of enforcement. It's clear that as long as Israel's principal sponsor, I'd say it's co-belligerent, the United States of America, is not committed to reining in Israel's assaults, those assaults are going to continue, regardless of what the International Court of Justice or the Security Council or other legal mechanisms at the international level rule. They are blocked by the power of the United States in actually giving force to the decisions that they take. And unfortunately, that's what we're seeing on the ground. This is an opportunity. Right. It provides a diplomatic tool and a legal tool to press for at least this 2 week plus pause on the ground. But the clock is already ticking. Nothing has changed so far. Israel has been explicit in its rejection of the resolution, and the United States has been explicit in its position that the resolution is non-binding. And therefore, if it's non-binding, it doesn't make any sense for them to take action to try to enforce it. The key element of the U.S.'s engagement on this was to try to keep the Security Council and the United Nations generally at arm's length so that all of the center of gravity would remain with them and their diplomatic, so-called diplomatic efforts in the Middle East, together with the Egyptians and the Qataris. Those talks have not borne fruit. Israel has repeatedly boycotted portions of those talks. An opportunity for a 2 week pause that this resolution provides is disappearing with each passing day. And so are the opportunities to try to turn that 2 week pause, as is suggested in the resolution, into something that is more lasting. The U.S. Refused to allow the word permanent, but something more more lasting. So the pressure is going to have to come from elsewhere. It's not going to come from these key pressure points. It's going to have to come from civil society. It's going to have to come from private actors. And again, as I said before, it's going to have to come from all of us.
And Craig McIver, I wanted to ask you, there's been for years now efforts to restructure the United Nations, especially the Security Council, precisely because of the overwhelming power that the old European major powers exercised over the Security Council. Do you think that this war and the inability of the UN to act to end it will now further fuel the move to reform the UN?
Well, one can hope, Juan, I have to say. I mean, I think what this genocide has done is it has revealed the weaknesses, the political compromises, the moral failings of the United Nations and other international institutions. It has shown itself to be wholly inadequate, wholly unable to respond to a genocide being committed with Western sponsorship, with the sponsorship of powerful Western states. If this were happening in a developing country in Africa or Asia, you would see a very different response. But when the perpetrators, the co-perpetrators, are the United States, the United Kingdom, European powers, the United Nations has shown itself unable to act. You see that even in the language of the Security Council resolution. We're talking about a situation of massive war crimes, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, and genocide. Because the Security Council is not set up to deal effectively with that, especially when one of its permanent members, or two of its permanent members at least, are implicated in that genocide, it's forced to dust off language about conflict as if this were a war between two states, rather than a campaign of annihilation by a heavily armed occupying power against a besieged civilian population. And that is not going to get the job done. You get a resolution that calls for a ceasefire. Even ceasefire language is not appropriate to a genocide, as the World Court itself has determined. And you get, you know, no language in here that, you know, condemns the perpetrators, that moves for accountability of perpetrators, that deals with the deployment of protection of the exposed civilian population, none of the things that would actually make a difference. And it's not just the Security Council. The political offices of the United Nations that have been set up to deal with issues like genocide, like sexual violence, like children in armed conflict, they have all failed miserably because they are politically compromised, politically controlled, unlike the independent human rights mechanisms that have done a terrific job, and the humanitarian aid workers that have done a terrific job in the UN system. These political offices and intergovernmental bodies have shown themselves to be wholly ineffective. So it certainly has increased the demand for reform. Whether there will be a willingness amongst the member states, and in particular amongst the P5, the most powerful member states of the United Nations, who sit with special rights on the Security Council in a mechanism that belongs in a Cold War museum, their lack of political will for change is what obstructs this. I still believe that demand from the ground can make a change. We saw it happen with apartheid in South Africa. We can see it happen as well if we work for it, for reforms in the UN, which I think have to happen. We need the United Nations. And on the other hand, for action against Israel's genocide.
Craig McIver, we just have 30 seconds, but the question of U.S. stopping military sales to Israel, an issue that certainly Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Merkley and others have called for, do you think that would make a difference?
Well, it would make a tremendous difference. As I've said before, the United States is not just tolerating this genocide. It is, in legal terms, complicit in the genocide because of its provision of military support, of weapons, of economic support, of diplomatic cover, of intelligence support, and, as I've said, the use of its official podiums to disseminate propaganda for a genocide on behalf of the Israelis. Any piece of that puzzle that is removed, and especially discontinuing the provision of military aid during the commission of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide, will make a very significant change, and in fact, a much more significant change than any international resolution could hope to make.
Craig McIver, international human rights lawyer, formerly served as the director of the New York office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, where he worked for more than 30 years as a human rights official, resigning in October over the UN's failure to adequately address the Israel-Palestine conflict and Israel's assault on Gaza. Coming up, a judge in New York has decided the first of Donald Trump's four criminal trials will begin April 15th. We'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston in 20 seconds. Money by the Drums. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A New York judge has set April 15th, the start date for Donald Trump's hush money trial, the first of Trump's four criminal trials. On that day, Trump will become the first former U.S. president to ever face a criminal trial. He's accused of falsifying business records in violation of New York law to cover up hush money payments made to adult film star Stormy Daniels. Trump was in court Monday when the judge rejected requests to delay the trial. The judge directly criticized Trump's legal team for alleging prosecutors had improperly withheld documents from them. Meanwhile, in a separate case, a New York State Appeals Court has reduced Trump's bond to $175 million, down from over $450 million, to cover a civil fraud judgment. The court also gave Trump 10 more days to pay. If Trump doesn't post the bond, New York Attorney General Letitia James could begin seizing some of his properties. To talk more about this and more, we are joined by David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, co-founder of DC Report, has covered Donald Trump since the 80s. His books include The Big Cheat, How Donald Trump Fleeced America and Enriched Himself and His Family. His latest piece for The New Republic is Today is the Day That 50 Years of Grifting Finally Comes to an End. So start off talking about the significance of this reduction of money he has to pay. Do you think he's going to post it in the next 10 days? And what exactly it means, David?
Well, it is not unusual for courts to lower the size of a bond from the entire amount owed to some lesser amount. There have been a number of cases of this, and it's discretionary on the part of the courts. The bond is not intended to be punitive. It is to guarantee payment. And Trump has other assets. So I think that was a reasonable decision of this court, much as it's upset many people who are critical of Donald. The appeal will probably not take all that long, a matter of months. And having read carefully Judge Ngoren's decision, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a professor of law, but not a lawyer. And many lawyers don't see any significant grounds for appeal. The best Trump can hope for is that the roughly $350 million base award, the bond is for half of that, might be shaved back a bit, but that's about all Trump can hope for.
And David, when he was asked how he would put up now the $175 million bond in his fraud case, Trump said in a news conference Monday, quote, "I don't need to borrow money. I have a lot of money." Your response to that?
Well, this goes right to the heart of how there is no sense of objective truth or facts in Donald's world. If Donald says something, that means it's so. And if you disagree, well, you know what, Juan? Fake news. His lawyers told the court that he couldn't possibly get a bond for $454 million. He couldn't do more than $100 million at most. And then he turns around and says, "I have $500 million in cash." Donald just makes this stuff up, and he's done it his entire life. He's done it for the 35 years that I've known him. He just makes it up. Now, my guess is that he is going to borrow this money somehow. He has another bond for $83 million from a Swiss insurer, Chubb, in the E. Jean Carroll second defamation case. And in this case, he's been meeting with, at least once, Jeffrey Yass, a guy who's worth about $25 billion and who owns 7% of ByteDance, the parent of TikTok. As president, Donald issued an executive order banning TikTok. A court threw that out because he doesn't have the authority to do that. He said it was a national security threat. Now he's saying we need TikTok. How interesting. He makes friends with the guy who has his fortune tied up in TikTok, and suddenly he's in favor of TikTok.
We also have recently heard that Steve Mnuchin, one of his cabinet members, Trump's old cabinet members, is trying to put together a team to buy ByteDance. Is that right? So you have billionaires owning X, right? Elon Musk, right wing,
yes.
Also owning TikTok.
Yes. What you're seeing in America, because of a series of Supreme Court decisions, the most important of which was Citizens United, is the conversion of American democracy into a cash register business. Whoever has the most money can buy the government policies they want. and there's a desperate need to change this. Steve Mnuchin was Trump's Treasury Secretary, became very wealthy by taking over a failed savings and loan and then enforcing the most trivial rules to force people out of their houses so he could get the value of their houses. As Treasury Secretary, he used government money so that he could fly in a comfort jet to see a celestial event. I mean, these are people who have no regard, Amy, for the public interest. They have no sense of sacrifice. They just look at government and go, wow, how rich can I get off of manipulating the government?
And David, your take on the significance of the most likely first trial now, criminal trial, being on the hush money case in New York?
Well, Judge Juan Marchand has made it very clear that he's fed up with and tired of the game playing by Trump's lawyers. They literally put themselves in the position of someone who murders their parents and then pleads for mercy because they're an orphan. They caused they were the ones who chose to wait to the last minute to seek certain documents, not from the state prosecutors, by the way, but from federal prosecutors. The case against Donald Trump in this matter is extraordinarily strong, in large part because Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's fixer and lawyer at the time, went to prison for these exact same events. But when Trump is convicted, and I think that's extraordinarily likely, he will appeal because there are 34 misdemeanor charges, which are then put together under a federal charge, not a state charge, that Trump was trying to subvert the 2020 election or the 2016 election by paying off the porn star Stormy Daniels. Trump will no doubt go to court after the trial and say, well, that's not fair. You can't do that. Because, of course, anything where law enforcement or aggrieved parties come after Trump isn't fair because Donald is special. He's above the rules. In fact, he tells his audiences he is their savior.
I wanted to go to Donald Trump leaving the courthouse on Monday.
This is all about election interference. This is all Biden-run things, meaning Biden and his thugs, because I don't know if he knows he's alive. And it's a shame. It's a shame what's happening to our country. This is election interference.
So we just have a minute to go. You've written three books on Donald Trump. You've won the Pulitzer Prize for your reporting, co-founded DC Report. Where do you think this is each headed? Let's be clear, this hush money trial that you think he will be convicted on, he cannot pardon himself if he becomes president because this is a state court. This is a state ruling.
Right. I don't think even this Supreme Court would uphold a federal pardon. Donald Trump, when this is over, if he does not get back to the White House, and he can do that even if he loses by 10 million votes, as I expect, in the fall, because we elect through the Electoral College, Donald Trump doesn't get back to the White House, then what lies ahead for him is financial ruin, bankruptcy, and prison, multiple long prison sentences from both state and federal criminal courts, because Donald Trump has committed serious criminal acts his whole life. And finally, after a half century of lying, cheating, stealing, plying 12-year-olds with liquor so they would gamble, doing extraordinary favors for one of the biggest cocaine traffickers in America, he's finally being held to account.
Finally, David K. Johnston, why isn't it raised that Laura Trump, who's now helping to head the RNC, is married to Eric Trump? She benefits from money going directly to the Trumps because he also has to pay up millions of dollars.
You know, 9 years ago, Amy, on your program, I said Donald Trump is a wannabe dictator. And when you're a dictator, you surround yourself with the people you trust, and the people you trust most are family. So he has now installed his daughter-in-law at the Republican National Committee, which is close to broke in terms of how much money parties should have, and has no money for down-ballot candidates, which is bad for the party.
David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. That does it for our show. Happy birthday, Nermeen Sheikh.